You can, everybody hear okay? The speaker's working fine. So, so as many of you know, so far this year, I have been on these Sunday mornings talking about the 12 steps of liberative dependent origination. The idea of dependent origination is very important in Buddhism. The idea that things don't arise out of the blue, things don't happen by magic, but rather they arise because certain conditions have to be in place for those things to happen. And liberation is like that. And in order for liberation, which is the ultimate goal of Buddhism, for that to occur, there has to be some condition set, a precursor set for that possibility. And the liberative dependent origination, those 12 steps, are not talked about that often in the Buddhist tradition. And the Buddha didn't mention it much. He just mentioned it as a list in two different places. But the list that is very popular, that's comparable to it, is just simply called the chain of the dependent origination. And this is the chain of how suffering occurs and is sustained and reoccurs. It's the causal connection, the causal nexus for suffering. And this is called then just the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. The chain of dependent origination is a circle, the cycle. Just goes around and around. It's an endless cycle. And the chain of liberative dependent origination, in that it ends with liberation, doesn't cycle back on itself. And maybe for practical purposes, for most people, it's a spiral. Because you do kind of come back to the same place again, but you're a little bit improved each time until finally the conditions are in place for final liberation. But it's not a cycle. Not a circle. So today I wanted to talk about the 12-fold chain of dependent origination and do it all in one day rather than half a year like I did for the other one. And it's a very important one. These 12 steps, 12 links, are things that practitioners often recommend that they memorize them, that they know what they are. So I'm going to go through the list once, just enumerate them, and then so that you all will have them ingrained in your mind, we'll go through it again, and you can repeat after me. And then I'll talk about them. So since it's a circle, it doesn't have to have a particular beginning, but for practical purposes, it's usually begun with ignorance. So ignorance. Dispositions, consciousness, name and form, the sense organs, organs of perception, contact, feeling tone, desire, craving, becoming, birth, old age and death. Old age and death being kind of a synonym for suffering here. So you want to do it together? See if you can get it in? So, ignorance. Consciousness. Disposition. No, I'm sorry, I was wrong. So, start again. Ignorance. Dispositions. Consciousness. Name and form. The sense organs, contact, feeling tone, desire, craving, becoming, birth, old age and death. So now you know them. So it begins with ignorance. And ignorance in the Buddhist tradition doesn't mean the absence of knowing, just because you don't know something, because then ignorance would always be, because you're not expected that you can know everything. Rather, ignorance in Buddhism is the act of ignoring. It's ignoring things. It's a It's a turning away, not being willing to look honestly at what's happening. A kind of clouding over of our perceptions and visions. We don't see what's happening. Ignorance is an action that we do, as opposed to just how we're born, not knowing things. And perhaps it's somewhat akin to maybe what Freud would call denial. The kind of same, maybe some of the same mechanism. Denial is also something we do. It's not just, you know, it's just a neutral ignorance and not knowing of something. And what we ignore, what we turn away from and don't really understand well, is a number of things. But the primary thing is suffering itself. If there's some suffering or some discomfort, the general human tendency is to not look at it very honestly or completely. There's a strong tendency, for example, to try to ignore it. There's a strong tendency to try to cover it up. There's a strong tendency to try to assign blame elsewhere. Someone else is responsible for my suffering. There's a strong tendency to what else do we do to suffering? Maybe that's kind of, everything could fit into those, I guess, but we get close to something which is uncomfortable, something which is we don't like, and we turn away. We don't want to be involved. We don't want to look at it carefully. We want to pretty it over. We want to make it look like, we want to justify it as being, oh, actually, it's not uncomfortable, it's actually a beautiful thing. It's full of happiness. And we see it very clearly, I think, in the subtleties of meditation practice, that our knee hurts, perhaps, or some psychological suffering arises. Maybe the first tendency is to pull away from it. I don't want to look at that. Oh, not now. Let's see if I can get concentrated on my breath. Maybe it'll go away. Maybe if I blame it on, you know, the particular time that I chose to meditate or the particular teacher I chose to sit with, you know, if I chose a different teacher, then, you know, his knee wouldn't have hurt. Then everything would be just fine, thank you. And so the poor teacher, you know, has to take responsibility then for things which is not his or hers. So there's all kinds of mechanisms in play. Some of you probably can recognize some of these as the common tendencies that you have, or in which we kind of, we glance off suffering. We don't look at it very directly and very honestly. Now the problem with that is that if you don't look at suffering very honestly, then you're not looking at some of the inner dynamics of your own mind. Because suffering in Buddhism is understood to arise out of your own mind. The conditions in the world might make it possible for you to suffer, but suffering, in the Buddhist definition of it, is an action that we do in our mind. In Buddhism, there's no book of Genesis like in the Bible, where you have the beginning of the Bible. But one of the possible beginnings of the Buddhist scripture is the opening of the Dhammapada, which says, all that we experience is preceded by mind, excelled by mind, made with mind. Speak and act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the ox that pulls the wagon. All that we experience is preceded by mind, excelled by mind, made with mind. Act and speak with a tranquil mind, a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a shadow that never leaves you. The idea being that what the mind does has a tremendous say, or the primary say, about our suffering and our happiness. So when we turn away from suffering and don't pay attention to it, we're turning away to some functioning, some activity of our own mind, some movement of clinging, of craving, of ambition, of aversion, of pushing things away. We're turning away from the tendencies we have, the dispositions that we have. So debate based on ignorance allows the possibility of our habit formations, our dispositions, our attitude towards life that we don't pay attention to begin functioning almost subconsciously, semi-consciously, because we're ignoring something. So for example, if I'm feeling lonely, which is an uncomfortable way to feel, and I don't want to pay attention to that, it still functions there, kind of churning up my stomach in a certain way. And if I go by an ice cream parlor, I'm not really recognizing what the suffering really is. I'm recognizing that I'm uncomfortable maybe, and I want somehow substitute that with some pleasure, or fill that with some physical pleasure. So coffee ice cream for me would be great. And so I go into the ice cream store, but I don't see how being propelled into the ice cream store is arising out of both my inability and uninterest to look at my own loneliness, and how I tend to kind of respond then semi-consciously out of that discomfort of loneliness to try to fill it with physical pleasure. So based on our ignorance, there arises dispositions. There arises dispositions of continued ignorance, but also sets of conditions for our dispositions, our habit formations, our attitude towards life to function semi-consciously at times. Based on these dispositions, that kind of attitudes towards life that we've developed and taken on and cultivated and acted on for a whole lifetime, there can be many, many of these that make up what we call our personality. There arises consciousness. And this is a little bit unusual for people in the West to think this way, because I think we think of consciousness as being somehow primary. Consciousness is like this blank screen of pure perception. The consciousness just is aware of whatever's happening in a very kind of neutral way. And, you know, if there's a beautiful person, that's just consciousness just taking in that beauty, just very, you know, neutrally just taking it in. But then we know, for example, that in different cultures, the definition of beauty differs. And so we have this little book for my son, kind of People in the World kind of book. And they have these pages, you know, all the hairdos that the world has, and all the things people do with their ears, and all things people do with their noses and tongues, and all the clothes they wear. And when I look at this, and the way they've chosen to depict Westerners, Western clothes and hairdos and all that, in contrast to everything else, I mean, it's all bizarre. But we take something, we take what we're used to as being beautiful, but it's not inherent in consciousness to see that beauty. It's very much conditioned by what is culturally appreciated in our particular culture. We take on these kind of cultural values, and then they function almost semi-consciously in the way that we perceive the world, in the way that consciousness is. Consciousness here is kind of like a mode of perception, a mood of perception. Our dispositions and attitudes that we have, our habit formations of mind, sets in place a certain mood or mode of how we actually experience the world itself, the consciousness itself. So consciousness in Buddhism is not this neutral screen, but is already, it's filled with activity. The very act of perceiving is filled with perception, with interpretation and associations, and there's kind of a making that happens. It's a cooperative endeavor. A moment of being conscious of something is a cooperative endeavor with what goes on in the mind. So in the opening of the Dhammapada, it says, mind precedes all experience. All that we experience is preceded by mind. It's made with mind. So based on our dispositions, then consciousness arises. Now consciousness then allows for the possibility of experiencing ourselves more fully. And the word here is for the human being is nama-rupa. Nama-rupa sometimes in English translations is translated as psychophysical being. But that's not very accurate, I believe, because physical implies kind of physical hard reality. The word rupa in Pali means has more the meaning of that which we experience as form. The best translation is not is rupa is form, the experience of sensations. And nama is mentalities, what we experience of our mind. So based on our consciousness, we have a particular experience of having a body and having a mind. We experience sensations of the body. We experience our organs of perception. We experience what goes on in our mind. Nama rupa. And this is a very important because the only thing we have access to in our direct experience, direct phenomenological experience, is the only thing we have direct experience of is our experience. We don't know something apart from how we experience it. You can intuit and use your intellect to kind of figure, oh, well, because I experienced this and because I have these physical experiences in the world, this body, you know, is made up of some soft parts and some hard parts. Buddhist practice is not a science in the sense that it's trying to describe how physical reality actually is. It's very interested in describing how we experience that reality. And the reason for that is that the world of our suffering is born out of how we experience reality. And so Buddhist psychology is trying to study how we experience reality. And so the nama rupa is our experience of our psychophysical body. It's not the psychophysical body itself. So based on our consciousness, the mode or mood of awareness that's colored by our dispositions and habit formations, we then have an experience of our body. And what this means is that, in part, the very sense we have of having hair and nose and cheeks and chests and stomachs and legs and all that is not neutral. But it's already an attitude or interpretation entwined, entangled with the very act of perception itself. And this has great consequences. And for some people it's a little bit unsettling because we really want to have the idea that we really know who we are in and of ourselves. Like we can have a real sense of who our body is. You can get a little sense of how this works and how quickly when we think about when we experience our body, many of us who have strong self-consciousness, body self-consciousness, how quickly the very experience of our thighs or hairline or whatever is so closely tied in with our discomfort around it. It's almost like just all we have to do is bring our attention to it and it's already uncomfortable. I don't know, that's not really the full picture of it to describe it, but maybe it gives you a little sense of it. Some people would say that our attitudes are almost embedded in a cellular level of our experience. Because the point being that our experience of reality, experience of body and mind, is not distinct from the attitudes and moods and interpretations and cultural biases that we've incorporated. But based on having some experience of the physical body, mental body, that allows for the possibility of there being the sense organs. And the sense organs are the six organs of perception or sensing, as it's posited by Buddhism. There is seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, the tactile sensation, touching, and then the sixth one, which is the mind organ. Buddhism kind of posits like there's an organ of perception in the mind that registers the fact that you're thinking or having a feeling or having an emotion or whatever's going on in your mind. There's some organ of perception that does that. So based on having this psychophysical experience of being, there then arises these six sense doors, which then make contact with the world. And again, the important thing here is that our contact with the world is not neutral. It's already biased. We come with our, even with our eyes closed, our eyes are kind of biased. We open our eyes, we're already biased to see the world in a certain way. And what, now, again, it may be a kind of not a good example of how this works, is if you sit in meditation, especially if you go on retreat for some time, and get really quiet, one of the things you're doing is you're quieting all these dispositions, all these attitudes that are kind of operating, they're active. And it's quite common for people to report that they open their eyes in meditation, or they go outside, and everything seems much sharper, much stiller, much more sparkling than it normally is. Now, is that sparkling, delightful nature of what we see? Why is it different in meditation as opposed to when we're not meditating? And I think it's because when we don't meditate, when the mind is not still, all these attitudes, dispositions, and busyness of the mind somehow interferes with the seeing itself. And so we actually see a little bit differently. So based on these six sense doors, there's seeing, touching, smelling, tasting, and all these things. There's contacting with the world. And there's no contact with the world without these six sense organs. And so there's contact, which I think is maybe the fifth link. Based on the link of contact, there is feeling tone. As soon as we have some contact or a sensation or experience of something in a very raw kind of way, we experience it as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So there's three possibilities. Some people say pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But the Buddha's way of saying it was pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant. And what this means is that there's a feeling tone to all experience that's universal. In a universal sense that all experiences, everything we experience has a feeling tone to it. Subtle or gross. If someone comes along and kind of strokes your cheek, it might feel kind of very nice. And it feels pleasant, perhaps. If someone comes and slaps your cheek, it feels unpleasant. It's an unpleasant physical sensation in and of itself. A beautiful sound. You know, it's hopefully a pleasant sensation. Some sounds are unpleasant. Certain ways chalk goes across chalkboard sometimes is quite unpleasant. Some of you, if you notice, before you shift your posture, whenever you shift your posture, if you pay attention, you probably see that since you're having some experience which is unpleasant, and based on that unpleasantness, you are acting in a certain way. You're responding in a certain way. Now the pleasant and unpleasantness of this of experience is not a moral issue. It's not a judgment. It's not a liking or not liking. It's not something, you know, here where we kind of really, you know, judge something. It's kind of in the very experience of contact itself. It could be said some of this is learned, acquired, like acquired taste, like beer. Many people have had the experience the first time they drink beer, doesn't taste very good. Or the first time they smoke a cigarette, you know, phew, how could they do this? But then it's an acquired taste. And somehow the associations and dispositions and the attitudes and the associations and everything come into play through consciousness, through dispositions, through the psychophysical organ. And it could be experienced as being pleasant, but it's already, you know, the moment of contact, it's one of these things. But it's not a judgment. It's not what we add. It's not a preference. Just very simple, direct. Now, based on whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, or neither, we tend to have a response. We tend to respond in some way. And here, the next link is desire. So, if in order to desire, another way to think of this chain is think backwards. In order for desire to arise, there needs to be contact with the world. We have to have that contact. We have to have some experience. If it's something that's unpleasant, we generally want to have aversion or push it away. If it's something pleasant, we want to have it. We want it. If it's a pleasant fantasy or imagination about something in the future, then we want that in the future. if it's a something fearful in the future, then we already tense up in the present. We get anxious. If it's something we actually in the present moment, there's a kind of pushing, pulling that can go on in the present moment itself. If it's neither pleasant or unpleasant, then it's one of the common responses is confusion, which is also uncomfortable. Confusion is often experienced as an unpleasant thing, and then the desire and the aversion arises out of the contact with confusion itself. In all these lists that Buddhism has, they list three kinds of desire here, this link. There's desire for sense pleasure, to be comfortable. The desire for wanting something to exist. The desire of wanting something not to exist. So pleasure is just you want to be soothed or comfortable. Wanting something to exist is a whole range of things, including we want a certain identity, we want to exist, or we want the ice cream to exist, or wanting something not to exist is we don't want the heat to exist, we don't want the loneliness to exist, we don't want something to exist, we don't want to exist in extreme forms. You know, people become suicidal, I don't want to exist, I want to be no one. Desire is relatively simple and it's not necessarily problematic. It's just simply the arising of a desire. It would be nice to have this. It would be nice to not have this kind of problem. It would be nice just, you know, just kind of a desire in and of itself is kind of has a kind of light feeling. What has a heavy feeling is the next link. And the heavy feeling is craving. And craving is latching on, is the addictive momentum behind the desire. It's the drivenness that arises in together with that desire. And again, you can think of these 12-fold links backwards. In order for craving to arise, there has to be in place desire. In order for desire to arise, there has to be in place some contact with something pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. So, and this is a very important distinction between desire and craving. Because Buddhism does not say you have to get rid of your desires, but it does say that you should somehow resolve, liberate your craving, because craving is really the source of suffering. Craving itself is a kind of suffering. Craving itself is a kind of tightening and contractedness of the mind and the heart. So based on so there's all kinds of ways in which we crave, or craving is another word for craving is clinging, attachment, and it is another list, a wonderful list. The four attachments, four things we cling to. We can cling to pleasure. We can cling to our opinions. We can cling to ourself, ideas we have of who we are. And we can cling to our ignorance, that we don't want to really know what's going on here. We just want to go in and get that ice cream. So this clamping down, which is craving. On the condition of craving, there arises, the word is usually translated into English as becoming, bhava. There's acting. There's the act of creation. There's acting on it. And acting on craving is to make something happen. It can be to make a certain identity for yourself. I want to be a certain kind of person, so I'm going to wear these kinds of clothes or this kind of makeup or have this kind of car or whatever, to create a certain identity for ourselves. I'm going to present myself. I'm only going to talk about these things to people so they see me in this kind of way. I'm only going to see myself in this kind of way. Very powerful movements of self-identity. We create this, we do it, we make it based on what we cling to. Arising out of the clinging. We wouldn't act with act of creation. I should say it a little bit differently. In the cycles of suffering, what leads to suffering, we don't act in neurotic ways. without there existing some kind of craving. Based on this action, this becoming, this identification, then something gets born. Something gets created. An identity is created. We create an identification, and then it exists there for us. We carry it around with us. And then we think we are a certain way. And this is, you know, epidemic in all of us, that we have certain ways in which we see ourselves as this is who I am, that was created by some activity in the past, and then we kind of sustain it through time. And it's one of the beautiful things is when people realize that they don't have to anymore hold on to identities that they've assumed were true since maybe sometimes their childhood. Ideas that they're unworthy, or ideas that they're inadequate, or ideas that somehow there's something about them which they need to hide from other people. So based on something gets born, if nothing else, a habit formation gets born. An expectation gets born. Expectation, oh, now that I have this wonderful ice cream, it's going to last forever. And of course, we know that ice creams don't last forever. But there's a subtle ways in which we kind of assume that many things are going to stay. But something does get created. So out of our becoming, out of our acting, something is born. And whatever is born will eventually pass away. So there's, based on birth, there is old age and death. And old age and death here is I take as a synonym for suffering. So if there's clinging and craving, and we act on that, then something gets created, which lays the conditions for further suffering. If I go and eat that ice cream instead of look at my loneliness, if nothing else, I'm strengthening the habit of not looking at what's really going on. I'm strengthening the habit of distracting myself from it with pleasure. I'm strengthening the habit of being attached to sensual pleasure, which the ice cream provides. I'm holding on to something as going to be the solution. But that just, you know, creates more suffering, because as long as that loneliness is there, my encounter with life is going to be tinged by that. So I don't know if this is the best example, but so that's a cycle. And so old age and death, as a synonym for suffering, is an uncomfortable experience. And that uncomfortable experience gives rise, can give rise, doesn't automatically, but is a condition for the arising of ignorance. There's no ignorance. Ignorance, the act of ignoring doesn't arise unless we're uncomfortable with something that we're unwilling to look at. So it's kind of like it repeats itself almost like at the feeling tone level. And then this all starts again. Now this starts again and again, goes around and around. And our habit formations, the habits of that we constantly respond in a certain way, take certain, you know, dig deeper and deeper ruts in our psyche. So if we're always acting and responding and following through on certain ways, then we can dig deeper and deeper ruts, and we kind of polish it and become smoother and smoother. So it becomes easier and easier to take that route again. If we're always expressing our anger, or freely expressing our anger, the possibility is that you're actually smoothing in a beautiful, you know, wonderful, smooth slide of anger, and you get even close to the edge of it, and you just, you know, it's so beautiful. I mean, it's been polished so beautiful, you know. Wow, you know, it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. You know, it's no one's ever polished anything so nice. And you get close, you want to see the beautiful, you know, your reflection in the polish, and you slide right down into it, right into the anger. So there's a number of places in these 12-fold chain, the 12 links of dependent origination, where we can step out. And the possibility of stepping out is really central to the Buddhist teachings. If you couldn't step out of it, then it would just be endless cycles of it. And we might get temporary relief, but temporary relief, rather than release, actually perpetuates a cycle. So, for example, catharsis is a wonderful form of relief. We can feel kind of purified temporarily afterwards, but catharsis is an act of doing that often arises out of certain momentum of desire and clinging, and it polishes that wonderful rut of habit formation that then feeds back in to ignorance and the recreation of more dispositions. They can do that. So there's a number of weak links in this 12-fold link of dependent origination. And one of the weak links, what's considered one of the weakest of the links, is the link between feeling tone and desire. And when we have any experience at all, you can notice how there's almost amoeba-like reaction inside of us, depending on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And then based on that, there arises a desire for something. And in order to create suffering, it's a desire for some object, something that's going to go away or stay or create pleasure. There's a possibility that with mindfulness is strong enough, we can see the sense tone, the feeling tone, and not let it become desire. Just be feeling tone. Just be, unpleasant. We don't have to do anything with unpleasantness. We don't have to react and respond. It's phenomenally liberating. It's phenomenally helpful, even in daily life, to learn to be comfortable with discomfort, to be in an uncomfortable situation, and not have it tick you off, not have it, lead to automatic reactions. But just, I'm uncomfortable here. I don't like it. I'm uncomfortable. But let's just hang out and see what happens. As opposed to immediately having desire, craving, and planning, and action come into play. So to allow the feeling tone just to be there without moving into desire. One of the next weakest links is between desire and craving. So a desire does arise. Then we just leave it as a desire. It'd be really good to have ice cream. Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? That's a nice idea. Okay. God willing, maybe I'll have ice cream. As opposed to, oh my God, I wonder when Gil's going to stop talking so I can go to the local store and get an ice cream, he just keeps talking about it. And, I'm not responsible for my suffering. It's Gil who brought it up. So just leave desire as desire and not let it feed into craving, to kind of stop it right there. And ignorance is also a weak link in the cycle. To choose not to ignore what's going on, but actually to look more deeply at what's actually happening. To look at our attitudes and feelings and dispositions towards life itself. To stop turning away from things, but turn towards things, whatever's going on. To look at the funny ways in which our mind works. We have this kind of, in Buddhism, they say that there's a upside down view that most people carry around with them. And the upside down view is the view of permanence, that things are permanent. But most of us don't think that many things are permanent. But we act as if that's the case. We get depressed. We get angry, we get sad, we get whatever. And we act as if, oh my God, if someone asked you, you're going to be sad forever, you probably say no. But the intensity and the way we get preoccupied and caught by it, it's almost as if we really believe this is it. And a tremendous amount of grace happens in life when you have some sense of how these things just cycle through, and they're here for a while and not here for a while. And there's a big difference between kind of latching onto things, oh my God, this is like the... kind of permanent, or this is it, versus, it's here for a while. So not to ignore things, but to look at our attitudes, look at dispositions, look at our habits formations, and really be honest what actually we do and what happens to us. Now, in some sense, this requires some effort and work. And this is the bad news, of course, right? You know, effort and work, oh my God, that's uncomfortable. You know, okay, forget Buddhism. Let's ignore that one now. What I've seen is that some people come to Buddhist practice, and I've known people who've done years of serious practice and gone on retreats and lots of sitting and whatever, and their attitude towards all of it has been they're waiting for some magic to work. If they put in their time, if they just show up and sit on the cushion, that something will happen, some magic or some act of grace, or you know, they're going to deserve to be liberated, if you know. And it isn't a matter of, you know, just doing your time and then something will happen. There has to be some sense of our responsibility, which means paying attention to the causal connections between things, paying attention to the causal network of how things arise, how a craving, how desire arises, how a reaction to pleasant and unpleasant arises, and to see how we respond and see there's a possibility of responding differently. And without some beginning of taking responsibility for how we create our own suffering, there is no Buddhist practice. There are times when a lot of Buddhist practice can feel like grace, but the heart of it, the foundation of it, is it taking responsibility for ourselves. And without that, there's no Buddhist practice. So when we start taking responsibility, then we can start spinning away from the cycle, endless cycle, and enter into that spiral movement that leads to liberation. When we feel something uncomfortable, or something comfortable, something pleasant or unpleasant, rather than replacing that with desire, we can replace it with faith. Oh, there's faith in the possibility of awakening. There's faith in the possibility of relating to non-clinging. Faith in the possibility, it's possible to open to an experience that doesn't attach to anything. And so when we get to some of these weak points in the link, we step off by having faith, by taking responsibility of paying attention, by choosing not to act that way anymore, best we can, and by beginning to look, to step off that cycle and look towards that which that possibility of non-clinging, of freedom, of release. We move towards faith based on our suffering. And those are the first two links of the liberative dependent origination that we talked about this year. That based on our suffering, suffering arises based on our experience of faith, in part. And then it moves on from there. And the Buddha was very clear that it's possible to have release. And the Buddha was very clear that it's said that the night of the Buddha's awakening, his liberation, his enlightenment, that's when he perceived the chain of dependent origination. How the genesis of suffering, how suffering is conditioned and arises. And at first he thought it was too much to tell people, to explain to people, they wouldn't get it. But as practice matures and deepens, the mind becomes a more sensitive instrument to begin picking up the ways in which these stuff work. And it's quite phenomenal. You can actually pick up, step by step, the links as they occur and arise in a moment-to-moment experience in practice. He did simplify it a little bit in the form of the Four Noble Truths, which is also a causal description. There's suffering and there's a cause of suffering. The 12-fold chain is a more elaborate attempt to try to clarify what's he saying there. A number of Buddhists, like the Dalai Lama, have said things like, it's more important to understand causality, the cause and effect relationships like this, that is to understand teachings of no self, of emptiness, or even of liberation. The Zen Master Dogen said, "It's the most important thing for Buddhists is to have a deep belief, deep faith in causality, in cause and effect. Because if there's no appreciation that there is a cause and effect relationship in the world, then there's no possibility for spiritual practice. There's no possibility of change. Then we'd be stuck inside this endless cycle. So mindfulness is paramount. It's really central to this. The mindfulness to pay attention. So we can notice what's actually happening and notice when we turn away from things, notice when we latch onto things, and to choose, slowly learning how to choose, to move into this really glorious, luminous world that doesn't cling, that doesn't latch on. So now you have both twelvefold steps of conditioned causality. Very central teachings in Buddhism. We can take maybe one or two questions. If something was not clear, or you want to anything at all. Yes.
Just wondering where you see addiction.
Addiction is a craving. So based on desire, there arises addiction. But you know, it's cyclical, right? So, and a lot. I mean, once you start studying the 12 full steps, intimate, you know. Yeah.
I have a tiny story about ignorance.
Please.
Several years ago, when Pat and I were teaching some Burmese monks English, they had a lot of pronunciation problems, and one of them that we thought was a problem, they would say, ignorance. And we would say, no, that's ignorance. And then after a while, we realized that that was a much better pronunciation, and we stopped correcting them.
Have you adopted it?
Yeah, around the house.
Ignorance. How's your ignorance today? Hopefully you're inspired to ignore less now. Yes, last one. Fiona.
You talked about dispositions. Where do they, how do they arise? All this is a cycle that's right out.
All right. I'm not sure if this answers your question, but this wheel can be kind of considered the wheel of samsara. And the Buddha said once that the origins of the samsara cannot be found. Like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? So there's a kind of it comes from beginningless time, this cycle. So it means we're born with some of these dispositions. But of course, what?
They are particular to universal dispositions, or
Generally, my understanding is they're more mostly personal. There are different spheres of or levels of rebirth where the people in that level kind of share certain ways of being. But generally, they're particular to each individual. And in traditional Buddhist teachings, it has to do with the stream of karma that you're participating in, that you're part of, that you contribute to. So based on the actions you do in this lifetime, that colors the stream, puts a certain spin on the stream of your consciousness, so that when you get reborn, that spin is on it. So if you have a very powerful disposition in this lifetime and keep acting out on that, the tendency is that disposition is going to be there in the next lifetime also. I don't know, people, if you want to leave, we talk about it over now, so if people want to have questions, we can
go. Can you just say the 12 steps again?
Oh, who wants to try to say it?
Ignorance.
Andrea.
Ignorance, dispositions, consciousness, body.
Not body, but...
sinful desire, craving, becoming, birth, origin.
So may all of you memorize that. It's actually a good thing to do. And if you're going to continue doing mindfulness practice for, you know, long term, to have that list in the background will be very useful.